This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, introducing Pete's E-Cups, letting you send a friend a cup. On the web at Pete's.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon lawmakers discuss possible means of opposing some provisions of the Patriot Act. Conservatives in Washington embrace environmentalism. And later on Free Speech Radio News, National Security Director John Negroponte testifies that wiretapping is essential to security and that the Army overlooks certain past convictions to cope with a recruiting shortfall.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,248 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. And IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 2nd, 2006. I'm Eduardo Delanderos Tierra.
And I'm Marlise Franklin. A short-term extension of the Patriot Act passed the House and the Senate is expected to follow suit. Senators of both parties have insisted on increased safeguards for civil liberties, and more time is needed for negotiations. Activists in Oregon are hoping for increased civic involvement. KBOO's Stephanie Potter has more.
Bush administration. After 9/11, the Bush administration pressed Congress to pass the Patriot Act, claiming that it was needed to keep Americans safe. Critics, however, have perceived it as part of a push to expand the powers of the executive branch and a threat to our basic liberties, for instance, authorizing investigations of bank accounts and computer searches.
There were a number of provisions that had sunset clauses in the original Patriot Act. Among those were the sneak and peek search authority, which can apply to any search, not just searches related to terrorists. There are two provisions directly related to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, that relate to the so-called library records provision and Section 218, which is the wiretap provision.
That was David Friedanke, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. He says Bush has been pressing to have all of the Patriot Act made permanent, and most of it has. But 16 of the provisions were set to expire. A new provision included in the Patriot Act by Senator Arlen Specter would give the Secret Service authority to make felony arrests of demonstrators as special events considered to be nationally significant. Hope Marston of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee has concerns.
There are things that will clamp down on people who are just exercising their freedom of speech at presidential political events.
Last year, Marston worked to have a bill introduced to the Oregon legislature that would have, among other things, prohibited state employees from participating in search and seizure techniques that violated the state constitution.
The essence of it was to uphold the Oregon Constitution in every way. The Oregon Constitution, I don't know if you're that familiar with it. I don't think I was all that familiar with it until we started studying it. And it is a lot more protective of our Bill of Rights than even the U.S. Constitution.
The bill died in committee last August when the legislature ended. David Friedanke again.
We wanted to follow up on a bill that had been passed by the Oregon Senate back in 2003 that called on Congress to revise, reform the Patriot Act. And, you know, we ran into a partisan brick wall, basically, in both the House and Senate.
Numerous communities throughout Oregon have demonstrated opposition to the Patriot Act.
For a local perspective, I can tell you that we've had 14 resolutions against the Patriot Act passed in Oregon. Ashland, Astoria, Benton County, Coos County, Corvallis, Douglas County, Eugene, Gaston, Lane County, Multnomah County, Port Orford, Portland, Talent, Wheeler. This state has taken a stand against the Patriot Act.
Fedanke says that in Congress, originally only three Oregon representatives opposed the act, but that's changed.
Fast forward to December of 2005, all of the House Democrats, including Darlene Hooley, voted against extension of the Patriot Act.
And Senator Wyden, who had voted for the Patriot Act in 2001, now calls it skewed. Last December, he provided a key vote to filibuster it.
Which is why the conference report got deadlocked in the Senate and why the issue is still deadlocked.
David Fedanke of the ACLU of Oregon. Over the next month or so, there will be opportunities to push for reforms in the Patriot Act.
There still is a lot of chance for people in the state of Oregon to work to influence Congress. If we can work now in this period of time when Bush is on the defensive about the National Security Agency spying, if we can put pressure on Congress to make a difference in Congress, I think that's where we need to focus our attention.
Hope Marston of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
Oregon has started its program to track medical errors at hospitals and determine what could have been done to prevent them. The Oregon Patient Safety Commission unanimously approved rules and guidelines for its effort to get hospitals to report serious mistakes. But the legislature created the commission in 2003, asking it to help reduce the risk of serious errors in the state's healthcare system. In 1999, the Institute of Medicine estimated that between 44,000 and 98,000 patients die in U.S. hospitals each year as a result of medical errors. The commission will not require hospitals to participate in the program, but those who refuse to take part will be reported on the commission's website.
Oregonians have largely heeded messages to recycle, stop littering, and wear seat belts, but a new advertising campaign asks them to take a bigger sacrifice. Stop driving so much. Transportation officials unveiled the ads in the Portland area, where they hope to ease the congestion that has forced rush hour drivers on average to experience 39 hours of delay in 2003. The federally financed ads are part of an almost $2 million campaign called Drive Less, Save More. The goal is to reduce the number of single driver trips and get each of the 700,000 households in the region to eliminate at least two car trips a week, mostly by combining several errands at once. Washington County Commission Chairman Tom Bryan is leading the effort and feels it should not be all that difficult. He says he attempts to do several errands during each car trip, and even his son has started asking him whether he needs anything when he leaves the house.
In his State of the Union address Tuesday, President Bush advocated a 75% reduction in petroleum imports. But will his conservative base support a mandate to equip the nation's road fleet for alternative fuels? In a recent visit to Washington, D.C., KBOO reporter Michael Gene Horowitz spoke to a key player in an energy coalition supported by elements of the political right.
Christine Hagebaum, Program Director of the Oregon Environmental Council.
Everybody expects the Greens to be interested in alternative energy, but we've got your hawks saying we've got to reduce our dependence on foreign oil because it's one way to avoid future conflict. Then you have the real right Christian coalitions saying that they don't want to send their money to countries where religious freedoms are being oppressed.
Is the political right irrevocably committed to warring in the Middle East, no matter how heavy the casualties? Or has the insurgency in Iraq and electoral triumphs in Iran and Palestine inspired some evangelicals and conservatives to think out of the petroleum box? In September 2004, the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, a D.C. think tank, launched a coalition called Set America Free, which committed itself to reducing America's oil consumption by half by the end of the decade. To be sure, the team was composed of some usual suspects. Environmental groups such as the American Council on Renewable Energy and the Coalition Advocating Smart Transportation. But it also included evangelist Gary Bauer and Frank Gaffney, director of the hard-nosed Center for Security Policy, which championed regime change in Iraq. In an interview with Gaffney at CSP headquarters in Washington, I asked what finally turned his group against oil importation. What came to worry CSP, he explained, was that oil shipments were largely sourced in
places that are at best unstable and at worst downright hostile to us. That is simply irresponsible and reckless and a national security problem of the first order. When you add on top of it that there are terrorists who understand that attacking the oil vulnerabilities of this country gives them an opportunity to inflict both economic and social problems on us, that's another reason. And then there's the problem, of course, that demand is going up. And when you combine all of those factors, it seems to me pretty clear that you have a situation on your hands that is not only unacceptable, but unsustainable.
So how does Set America Free contemplate reducing importation? The director initially indicates that two-thirds of America's oil is consumed by our road transportation fleet. So he looks to three alternative fuels to power our cars, vans, buses, and trucks.
One is the family of alcohol-based fuels called ethanol. Another is the family of alcohol-based fuels called methanol. And then the third is electricity. These are fuels that are well understood, that are to varying degrees already being supplied, but not nearly the quantity that we need or should be able to produce. And we have not taken the steps necessary to equip our automotive fleets to make full use of them.
Gaffney envisions hybrid vehicles whose combustion engines are powered by alcohol-based fuels, but whose batteries would make a more ambitious contribution than currently. Under the scheme, hybrid drivers would have
the opportunity to charge the battery, not by simple braking action, but by recharging it like one does one's cell phone or laptop, ideally at night, off of the electrical grid. To the extent you can combine a plug-in feature and a flexible fuel feature for the internal combustion part of the hybrid, you have the ability, in theory, to greatly reduce the amount of gasoline that the average consumer is using. By some estimates, we could get something on the order of 500 miles per gallon of gasoline.
Besides Gaffney and Bauer, Set America Free has enlisted the support of some other influential figures in the nation's capital.
Jim Woolsey, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency under President Clinton, Bud McFarlane, National Security Advisor to President Reagan, Boyden Gray, counsel to President Bush, 41.
Rather than preach to the environmentalist choir, the coalition has sought to
explain to members of the so-called centrist coalition in the Senate these ideas and encourage them to take them up. Some offices have actually asked for information. In other cases, I think it's sort of cold calls.
But despite its prestigious roster, Set America Free hasn't yet been able to win Congress over. The coalition concedes that last summer's energy policy bill failed to mandate fleet conversion to flexible fuels, as Brazil is requiring by 2008. Gaffney attributes the coalition's weak congressional debut to formidable opposition.
The cumulative weight of what a friend of mine calls the sum of all lobbies. The oil industry, the automotive industry, the tire manufacturing industry, and others that benefited very handsomely from that bill.
Back here in Oregon, Christine Hagebauma was also disappointed with the energy policy bill.
However, it does have the first renewable fuel mandate ever, basically saying that petroleum industry needs to blend a certain amount of ethanol or biodiesel into the fuel it sells. That's a first step. It's a good step, but there's a long ways to go.
For KBOO News, this is Michael Gene Hurwitz.
The Oregon Supreme Court today upheld a $79.5 million punitive damages award to the family of an Oregon smoker who died of lung cancer. In its ruling, the state high court says the amount is not excessive given what it calls the, quote, reprehensible, unquote, conduct of tobacco giant Philip Morris in marketing cigarettes. Today, the decision also responds to a U.S. Supreme Court decision telling Oregon courts to consider whether the award in the law lawsuit against Philip Morris was excessive. The state Supreme Court said it was not excessive given, quote, such extreme and outrageous circumstances, end quote. Back in 1999, a county court jury awarded the money to the family of Jesse Williams, a janitor who died of lung cancer at the age of 67. Williams' family was had also received $500,000 in non-economic damages to compensate for pain and suffering.
Democrat Pete Sorensen, who is opposing Governor Kulongoski in the May primary, has outlined a plan to help Oregon community colleges. His plan, to eliminate the state's corporate income tax kicker. Sorensen is a Lane County commissioner and told an audience at the Lane Community College that ending the kicker for corporations could give the state $100 million per biennium for higher education. Oregon is the only state in the country with a kicker law. Businesses get the rebate in the form of a tax credit when corporate income tax collections in a two-year budget cycle come in at least 2% above the legislature's projections. Meanwhile, Kulongoski in recent months has touted his so-called education enterprise proposal. Beginning in the 2007 to 2009 biennium, it would increase funding for every level of the state's education system.
President Bush says patients are the prescription for the nation's health care system. In his State of the Union address last night, he proposed consumer-directed or consumer-driven health care plans and health savings accounts to help control skyrocketing health costs. KBOO's Jamie Heim reports.
President Bush wants consumers to take more responsibility for fixing the nation's health care system. In his State of the Union address earlier this week, he announced a consumer-directed health care plan that would have consumers paying more out of pocket in the hopes they'll then be more careful about health spending. Maribeth Healy is with Oregonians for Health Security. She says the idea will just cost Oregonians more while not dealing with the growing number of uninsured and skyrocketing costs.
It is cost shifting. We already have that problem. Employers are shifting more costs to workers. That hasn't done anything to reduce the cost of health care.
Healy says the plan is little more than a repackaging of the president's Social Security reforms, where consumers take all the risks and companies get guaranteed profits.
What we really need is accountability in the insurance and hospital industries, who are really the leading cost drivers in this healthcare crisis.
Supporters of the plan say it encourages consumers to shop around for good prices and would make services more competitive. However, Tanisha White with a statewide community organization called Oregon Action just doesn't see how the president's plan will help people who are already struggling to get by.
It's making our health care go up in our copayment and our prescription drugs, and I can't afford it.
Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Jamie Heim, KBOO News.
TriWest, the Department of Defense contractor administering the military's health care program in Oregon, is giving webcams to the 41st Brigade Combat Team, departing soon for Afghanistan. Officials for the health care contractors say the webcams will promote better health among deployed troops by giving them better communication with their families while they're fighting in the Middle East. The 41st Brigade is a unit of the Oregon National Guard and is based in Salem. The webcams will be presented this Saturday, February 4th, during a brigade mobilization ceremony. Three webcams will go with the unit and three will stay in Oregon so the families can talk face-to-face half a world away.
Flood warnings have been issued for a number of rivers in Oregon. The rivers to watch out for are the Lukemute River in Polk and Benton counties, the Pudding River in Clackamas and Marion counties, and the Tualatin River in Washington County. The Pudding River at Aurora is forecast to rise above flood level this evening and is expected to crest Friday morning. The Tualatin River near Dilley was forecast to crest midday today and remain above flood stage through tomorrow.
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration officials say La Nina could be contributing to a wet winter in the Northwest. Forecasters with the Climate Prediction Center made the announcement today at the American Meteorological Society's meeting in Atlanta. They confirm a slight cooling of parts of the Pacific Ocean and changes in the jet stream. La Niña tend to encourage wet weather in the Pacific Northwest and dry conditions in the south, but they're not completely blaming this one for the wet winter in the northwest, though. Forecasters say the latest La Niña may last through the summer. La Niña is the opposite of the better-known El Niño, which is a warming of the Pacific. Both occur every few years and can affect weather around the world. The last La Niña occurred about 5 years ago.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. here, Proverbial Perspectives. At 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with a low of around 41. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy, high around 56. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The time is 5:22, and now it's daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
An old bumper sticker says, "It'll be a great day when our schools get all the money that they need and the Pentagon has to hold bake sales." Well, guess who is now having to hold bake sales to get the supplies they need? Not the Pentagon itself, of course. Its official budget is $500 billion a year. But the grunts, the soldiers putting their lives on the line in Bush's war, are so inadequately supplied by the warmongering Bushites that they must turn to family members, churches, or charity to get vital battle gear. It's been widely reported that the Bushites have failed miserably to provide the life-saving armor that all of our vulnerable soldiers need. But less well known is that even basic items are not provided, such as ballistic glasses that are less likely to fog up in Iraq's 120-degree heat, shirts and socks that wick sweat away from the body, helmet sweatbands, and water pouches. These are products that can make a life-or-death difference for our men and women who are fighting in this land of oppressive heat, and all are readily available in the U.S. market. In fact, they are commonly issued to police forces here at home. The Pentagon, however, says that such items are too costly, so soldiers wanting them must get them on their own. Hello, Pentagon brass. You routinely waste billions of our tax dollars on razzle-dazzle weaponry that isn't needed and doesn't work, but you can't find a few extra dollars to give every grunt the goggles and socks they need? Besides, paychecks for soldiers are as low as $14,000 a year. Why should their safety be a matter of personal affordability? This is Jim Hightower saying, such nonprofit groups as Operation Enduring Support have stepped up and are doing what they can to help. They raise money to buy some of these items for some of the soldiers being shipped out to Iraq. But come on, where are the Bushites in Congress when it comes to making support our troops more than an empty political slogan? Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Molly Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Former Enron Corporation CEO Jeffrey Skilling gave a misleading information to Wall Street analysts about the earnings of highly touted business unit in 2001. The company's former head of investor relations testified that today Skilling did not disclose in conference calls with analysts that the Enron Retail Energy Division had suffered $726 million in first-half losses from its contracts and insisted as well that the unit was profitable. Mark Koning told jurors, quote, "It would have been a big surprise, a negative surprise, a large surprise to investors," unquote, had they known the truth. Portland's electrical utility PGE remains one of Enron's last corporate assets. It is currently being offered for sale to an out-of-state buyout firm. Eduardo?
La Center City officials in the state of Washington voted yesterday to ask federal officials to set aside a federal opinion saying the Cowlitz tribe has historic ties to its proposed casino site along the west side of Interstate 5. The Vancouver Columbian newspaper reports that the council's 3-2 vote came on the same night that Cowlitz Tribal Chairman John Barnett presented Mayor Jim Irish with an agreement that would make the two governments cooperating neighbors, not litigious rivals. Council members Bob Smith, Linda Tracy, and Troy Van Tinter voted to send a letter objecting to the process U.S. Interior Secretary Gail Norton used to reach its conclusions about the college tribe's historic ties to the area. The tribe's proposed agreement would compensate the city for some of the gambling taxes it stands to lose if the tribe's $510 million casino complex is built near La Center. The tribe would pay the city a maximum of $3 million annually for 10 years. The exact amount would be determined by subtracting the city's gambling revenue from its four non-tribal card rooms from the $3 million guarantee. The draft agreement requires the city to spend the money on sewers, roads, and other construction projects to offset the casino's expected effect on the small city of 2,100.
The Longview Daily News reports that Washington Secretary of State Sam Reed presented the state's first consolidated list of registered voters Wednesday. The high-profile election reform measure has already weeded out thousands of voter registrations. Previously, the state's 39 counties kept separate lists. The federal government mandated all states develop statewide voter databases in the wake of the 2000 presidential vote in Florida. During the 2004 Washington gubernatorial election, in which Chris Gregoire defeated Dino Rossi by 133 votes, Republicans claimed fraudulent votes cost Rossi the election. They were not able to prove it in court. In combined 387 registered in more than one county and 5,244 who had died. That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 2nd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8030 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM. On translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Jamie Heim. Our assistant producer is Spencer Raymond. Tonight's audio editor is Rabia Yeaman. Special thanks to reporters Stephanie Potter, Michael Horowitz, and Jamie Heim. Our engineer is Brian Averill, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Marlise Franklin.
And I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow morning at 7, hear the KBOO Morning News. And then at 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. The guest is Daryl Hunt, who spent 20 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. His experience is told in the new film called The Trials of Daryl Hunt. Then at 9, it's APA Compass with the topic, I Love Orientals, Cultural Appreciation or Theft. Then at 10, hear guests from Body Talk. It's a system of improved communication synchronization within and between all the elements of the body mind for better health. At 10:30, on Sounds of Awareness, Lisa Lieberman, author of A Stranger Among Us, talks about in-home support for children with autism or spectrum disorder. Then at 11, it's, of course, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community, your radio station. Arte, amor, y ciao.
Ciao.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 2nd of February, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, the IAEA holds an emergency meeting to finalize a report on Iran's nuclear activities. On Capitol Hill, the tax cut debate continues the day after the House passes a series of tax cut provisions. And we'll hear the second part of our exclusive one-on-one interview with Subcomandante Marcos.
We think fundamentally that the future story of Latin America, not only of Mexico, but for all of Latin America, will be constructed from the bottom.
All this and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines.
The Anglo-Dutch oil company Shell today announced record profits for a British company. Consumer groups are calling on the government to implement a windfall tax. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Shell's reported profits of almost $23 billion isn't far off $3 billion an hour. Most of that came from oil and gas extraction and strongly benefited from the rising cost of crude oil. It's great news for shareholders, say campaigners, but it's very bad news for Britain's 1.8 million households currently victims of fuel poverty. Households that spend more than 10% of their income on heating and power are deemed to be in fuel poverty. And that's only set to rise as Britain continues to suffer along with the rest of Europe from problems with gas supplies as Russia and the Ukraine, who pipes the gas to Europe, fight over pricing. The Confederation of British Industry has warned that if this winter is as cold as predicted, there could be power shortfalls caused by the rising domestic demand to keep warm. That could even lead to factory shutdowns and a three-day working week. Britain has only 11 days' supply of gas in reserve. The government has not commented on the possibility of a windfall tax. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
At airtime, the Associated Press is reporting that a fully loaded oil tanker has run aground in Alaska. Some fuel is reportedly present in the water, but it is unclear if it is from a leak of the ship or from damaged refinery fuel lines. Colombia and Ecuador have been on the verge of a diplomatic crisis since last week after an incursion by members of the Colombian armed forces into Ecuadorian territory. From Bogota, Nicole Carson has more.
Ecuadorian Defense Minister Osvaldo Jarin has sent airplanes and troops to the common border with Colombia after the Colombian armed forces crossed over into Ecuador last week. This is the third incident of Colombian troops illegally crossing the border and fighting in Ecuador in the past 4 months. In pursuit of a top rebel leader, the Colombian armed forces engaged in heavy combat with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, in the southern border state of Putumayo on January 28th. According to locals in the Sucumbíos province of Ecuador, during the battle, some 300 Colombian soldiers, 3 Black Hawk helicopters, and 2 planes belonging to the Colombian armed forces opened fire around their villages. Defense Minister Farin activated Ecuador's aerial defense system, saying that Colombia's repeated incursions into Ecuador's territory are premeditated. A bilateral commission is currently investigating the incident, and Colombia says it will respond to Ecuador once the results from the investigation are in. From Bogota, I am Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
A Norwegian truce monitoring group in Sri Lanka says the recent abduction of 10 Tamil aid workers could threaten peace talks that the government and the Tamil Tiger rebels agreed to a week ago. Ponia Manavanasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
The Tamil Rehabilitation Organization, or TRO, reported 10 of its aid workers and staff members were abducted Sunday near an army camp in eastern Tibet. They entered into a ceasefire agreement in 2002 to bring an end to the 2 decades of ethnic conflict. Erik Sørheim, the visiting Norwegian peace envoy, announced last week both parties have agreed to meet in Geneva to resume peace talks that stalled 2 years ago. The Sri Lankan conflict has resulted in the deaths of more than 65,000 civilians in Sri Lanka.
Online magazine Salon.com is reporting that the army is overlooking certain past convictions in order to cope with a recruiting shortfall. Salon obtained documents under the Freedom of Information Act that show an increase in Pentagon-approved waivers to allow potential recruits with past offenses into the armed services. According to figures handed over by the Pentagon's Public Affairs Office, waivers were granted to 17% of recruits admitted into the Army in 2005. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate is voting on a series of tax cut provisions that would extend some cuts that are already in place and add new ones. Taxpayers would save $70 billion in the next 5 years. The tax cut debate continues on the Senate floor today, one day after the House passed a federal budget savings plan amounting to $40 billion. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill. In his State of the Union address, the president urged Congress to cut federal spending and to make permanent his tax cuts.
Americans should not fear our economic future.
Just hours after his address, the Republican-led Congress began instituting his policies. The House narrowly passed legislation yesterday that would cut nearly $40 billion from government spending in the next 5 years. That is a total of 0.3% of the federal budget. But this is the second time around for this bill due to last-minute additions to the text. In the Senate, Vice President Dick Cheney had to break a tie on this bill. This time in the House, the bill gained 4 Republican opposition votes, having a final tally of 216 to 214. They and all House Democrats say cuts will hit the poor the hardest. The programs seeing the largest cuts include more than $11 billion in Medicaid and Medicare and nearly $12 billion in cuts to student loan programs. Additional reductions include the federal welfare program and child care programs. Joan Entmacher is head of the National Women's Law Center.
We're hoping that states will be able to fill in some of the gaps, although there are so many gaps, it's going to be very difficult.
This is the first time cuts to social programs have been made in a decade. But the 216 proponents of the bill say the $40 billion in cuts will decrease federal spending. Is the Tax Conciliation Act, which would save taxpayers up to $70 billion in the next 5 years. It is currently being debated in the Senate, also for the second time, also because of a technicality. The administrative problem could enable Democrats to strip unwanted provisions. Many Democrats oppose the capital gains tax and dividends tax, saying it disproportionately benefits the wealthiest Americans. And the Democrats are using this opportunity to attach amendments to the bill. Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan from North Dakota spoke about a loophole that he is trying to close.
The product from China, sell it in Cincinnati or Toledo or Pittsburgh, and then run their income through the Grand Cayman Islands.
Other amendments would provide aid to low-income housing programs, and another would fund Medicare drug programs. Critics also say that the $40 billion just passed by Congress in savings would be offset by the $70 billion in tax cuts. Again, Joan Entmacher from the National Women's Law Center.
The spending cuts weren't to control the deficit. They were to pay part of the cost of tax cuts, so that at the end of the day, you know, we have $30 billion more in deficit.
But Republicans say the tax cuts would jumpstart the economy by encouraging investment and spending. Republican Senator Rick Santorum from Pennsylvania.
Policy that believes in the innovation and the energy of the American people, that if you unshackle them from higher tax rates, they will produce more, they'll create more jobs.
The president will release his budget proposal to Congress on Monday, where major cuts in mandatory spending are expected, along with additional tax cut proposals. He is also expected to ask Congress for an additional $70 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Director of National Intelligence John Negroponte testified today in front of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence to present an annual assessment of national threats. He stressed that the globalization of technologies and the emergence of transnational networks complicates intelligence gathering and makes the surveillance of international phone calls absolutely necessary. Anastasia Netstitska reports from Washington, D.C.
During today's testimony, John Negroponte listed major threats to U.S. security, such as spread of WMDs, pandemics, narcotics trafficking, and international terrorist networks. He said that these threats are aggravated by globalization and make for a special need to control the countries that do not cooperate.
We need to work hand in hand with other responsible nations. Fortunately, the vast majority of governments in the world are responsible and responsive. But those that are not are neither few in numbers nor lacking in material resources and geopolitical influence.
One question and answer session called into question the motivation behind holding closed sessions, particularly with regard to Al-Qaeda's communications. Senator Levin from Michigan questions Deputy Director for National Intelligence General Hayden.
Can you give us an estimate as to the number of such communications which were tracked by NSA last year? Just an estimate.
Can't do that.
Sorry. I'd be very uncomfortable doing it in open session, and I don't actually know that number.
I think it is a denial. Basically, the administration wants to be unchecked, either by a court or by the Congress.
Other unanswered question was asked by Senator Feingold from Wisconsin.
Can you assure us today that there are not other intelligence collection, and I emphasize collection programs, that you are aware of and that you are keeping from the full Intelligence Committee?
Senator, I don't know if I can comment on that in an open session.
Senate Judiciary Committee will hold a series of hearings next week to question Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez concerning the legality of a domestic eavesdropping program. Other issue on the agenda will be how intelligence agencies are dealing with the information thus obtained. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditskaya in Washington, D.C.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, held an emergency meeting in Vienna today to finalize a report on Iran's nuclear activities. The report will then be sent to the UN Security Council in New York. The document is the result of late-night talks in the Austrian capital between the five permanent members of the Security Council. Representatives from the U.S., the United Kingdom, China, Russia, and France, plus Germany, coordinated their final position on Tuesday. As Saida Jamshidi reports, the formal referral of Iran's nuclear case to the Security Council could result in sanctions being imposed against Tehran in March.
For 30 years, Tom Graham was a former special presidential envoy for arms control, non-proliferation, and disarmament. He now teaches political science at the University of Washington.
They're going to ask the International Atomic Energy Agency to report, not refer, report to the Security Council what Iran needs to do to come into compliance.
American diplomats are said to be elated with the possibility of Iran facing sanctions by the UN Security Council. They see it as a step forward to calling Iran to task for its clandestine nuclear program. Meanwhile, between now and March, when the IAEA will report on Iran's compliance, officials in Tehran will have some time to convince the international community that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Iran can possibly avoid sanctions with the Russian compromise plan to produce necessary fuel on Russian soil. Under Moscow's plan, the nuclear waste, which is the primary source for the material to produce nuclear weapons, would remain in Russia. But, as the University of Washington's Tom Graham says, Iran's response has been cool and negative, and he outlines three possible outcomes.
One is that they would accept, and then that would be the end of the problem, at least for now. Second possibility is they would reject it, and there would be a serious debate in the Security Council about sanctions. The third possibility is they could continue to say, well, we're seriously considering it, but we want to make a few little changes here and there and discussions.
For their part, Iranian politicians aren't at all happy with the possibility of being referred to a Security Council on future sanctions. Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, Ali Larijani, has been quoted by state-owned television as saying, "We consider any referral or reporting of Iran to the Security Council as the end of diplomacy." Mehrdad Meshayekhi is the professor of political sciences at Georgetown University and an observer of Iranian politics.
The reason they're angry is because based on their behind-the-door negotiations with Europeans and also with the Chinese and also with the Russians, they expected with the kind of concessions, economic concessions that Iran is giving these countries, this should have a softening effect on their decision.
With Iranian officials feeling threatened, they are not willing to give up their right to produce nuclear fuel, which they have always claimed is for peaceful purposes. But on the other hand, they cannot seem to gain the international community's trust to produce such fuel in Iran. Again, Mehrdad Meshayekhi.
The powers, Europeans or Americans, should be very clear and speak very clearly, you know, to Iranians, telling them that, you know, look, as a nation, obviously, you have the right. Nobody is questioning your right to own the states. And therefore, there is a fear that, you know, with that capacity, they may take some destructive course of actions or policies. And this is what really worries us.
The limitations of time are very tight for the government of Iran. it has only the month of February to consider the Russian compromise plan and to convince the United States and European governments that their need to produce nuclear fuel is for peaceful uses. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Saida Jamshidi.
As India grows closer to the U.S. in its bilateral relations, it is also putting an end to its nuclear isolation. The U.S.-India deal is India's masterstroke for integrating itself in the global nuclear framework and drawing its advantages. The Indian government is apparently banking on post-Cold War global realities, as well as on the Bush administration's commitment that it is in the strategic interests of the United States for India to emerge as a major global power. FSRN's Binu Alex has more.
Today we announce the completion of the next steps in strategic partnership. Completing this partnership will help us further enhance our cooperation in the areas of civil nuclear, civil space, and high technology commerce.
This is what George W. Bush said during Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh's visit to Washington last year. Since then, both countries have been forging closer ties. Building on that momentum, a delegation of the U.S.-India Business Council is on a visit to India's largest land and naval systems exhibition currently in New Delhi. According to the expo organizers, U.S. have the biggest presence, putting India's traditional arms suppliers, Russia, to fourth place. For the first time, as per the figures released by Defense Ministry, the South Asian nation outdid China in buying military hardware and software worth in the world. In an address to Parliament recently, the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh sounded optimistic.
I am convinced our destiny and our salvation lies in closer involvement with the evolving global economy.
But for New Delhi's Congress-led government, with outside support from India's left parties, the move to develop closer U.S. ties will not be easy. India's growing confidence as an emerging power was the signing of the new defense framework with the U.S. last July, strongly opposed by the left parties. Communist Party of India General Secretary Prakash Karat.
This is a framework. We'll have to flesh it out. It's only a framework. Let it remain a framework, a skeleton, which can be disposed of in the dustbin.
Nevertheless, a U.S.-India bilateral defense relationship is seen by observers as an agreement between two unequal partners. The U.S. retains all the control and India puts itself in danger of being compelled to follow suit in moments of political and military crisis. The alliance also has critics in the U.S. Some lawmakers argue that the U.S. cannot afford to play favorites and break the rules of the non-proliferation regime to favor one country at the risk of undermining critical international treaties in nuclear weapons. While the non-proliferation lobby in the U.S. works against the ratification of the U.S.-India nuclear pact, major U.S. corporations doing business in India are lobbying for the enactment of legislation needed to recognize India as a responsible nuclear power. At the same time, India's energy needs remains a top priority for the government. According to researchers in New Delhi-based Institute of Peace and Conflict Studies, this is the reason that despite international opposition, India announced an arms sale to Myanmar last week, as the Singh administration eyed huge crude reserves there. This was also the reason that in the midst of strong domestic opposition, India had previously taken an opposing stance to the U.S. in reference to Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. During the last voting on the resolution, Shyam Saran, the Indian Foreign Secretary, had issued this statement regarding Iran.
We do not believe that the time has come for this matter to be remitted to the Security Council. It is also a point that we have clearly made, and we have also clearly stated in the explanation of vote that we certainly do not regard the current situation as constituting any kind of threat to international peace and security.
New Delhi's decision to vote in favor of the U.S.-sponsored motion critical of Iran in the IAEA evoked strong reactions back home. Iran has been a fellow member of the non-aligned movement with India against the policies and bullying tactics of US. But when President Bush visits India in March, A result is expected on substantial defense cooperation, civilian nuclear power, agriculture, lobbying for a vote supportive of the U.S. stance on Iran's nuclear program, and most importantly, on science and technology knowledge transfers, an issue the U.S. President
Los Angeles City Council asking legislators to oppose anti-immigrant assaults and support a measure that would make the city a sanctuary for immigrants. FSRN's Leilani Albano has more.
Fed up with the recent upsurge of attacks against immigrants, community members held a demonstration in front of La Placita Catholic Church this morning, calling for the city council to support their efforts. At issue is the Sensenbrenner Immigration Reform Bill, which would reintroduce a guest worker or bracero program, as well as impose harsh penalties on undocumented immigrants and those who aid them. Father Richard Estrada, who led a prayer vigil before the march, is a parish missionary priest and vocal opponent of the Bush administration's latest attempts to stifle immigration.
We say no to the criminalization of the undocumented community. We're here to call attention to the senators and to the general public. We want to reform the immigration laws. Make sure that they're just and they're human.
If passed, the Sensenbrenner bill would expand the definition of smuggling to anyone who assists or directs an undocumented person to reside or remain in the United States. Punishment for such a crime could lead to 5 years in prison. LA activists are urging lawmakers to sign a petition that would make the city a sanctuary for immigrants. They also want them to oppose recent legislative attacks against undocumented persons. Estrada also says that the Bracero program, which was instituted from 1942 to 1964, should not be brought back until the government. Gloria Sacedo agrees. Sacedo, who is director of Hermandad Mexicana, says that U.S. legislators should look to the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants within its borders instead.
We have a lot of people already here without status, without documents. And I think so we need to, the president need to go and look at these 11 million people first to have a legal status here.
To counter the Sensenbrenner bill, activists are calling for comprehensive immigration reform, which would legalize immigrants already residing in the United States. For FSRN, this is Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
Zapatista Subcomandante Marcos, now known as Delegate Zero, has already made his way through six states in southern Mexico as part of the other campaign. I caught up with him a few days ago at the Center for the Documentation of Son Jarocho in Jaltipan, Veracruz, for an exclusive one-on-one interview. Subcomandante, for people in Latin America, there's often a lot of hope in politicians like Lula in Brazil, Kirchner in Argentina, or Chavez in Venezuela. How do you...
Not only in our own country, but in Latin America particularly. When Evo Morales presented this invitation for his presidential inauguration, we said that we were not turning our gaze upward, neither in Bolivia nor in Latin America. And in that sense, we don't judge governments whose judgment belongs to the people who are there.
Miramos con interés la movilización indígena boliviana, la ecuatoriana. De hecho, están mencionados en la sexta declaración.
We look with interest at the Bolivian indigenous mobilization and the Ecuadorian one. In fact, they are mentioned in the sixth declaration. The struggle of the Argentine youth, fundamentally this whole Picatero movement, and of the youth in general in Argentina with whom we strongly identify, also with the movement to recover memory of the pain from what was the long night of terror in Argentina, in Uruguay, in Chile. And in that sense, we prefer to look at the bottom, exchange experiences, and understand their own assessment of what is happening.
Nosotros pensamos fundamentalmente que la historia futura de América Latina.
We think fundamentally that the future story of Latin America, not only of Mexico, but for all of Latin America, will be constructed from the bottom, that the rest, in any case, are steps, maybe false ones, maybe firm ones. That's yet to be seen. But fundamentally, it will be the people from the bottom that will be able to take charge of it, organizing themselves in another way. Or the old parameters should serve as a reference, yes, of what was done, but not as something that should be readopted to do something new.
¿Qué pueden hacer los hombres para alzar?
And what can men do, for example, to raise the level of women's representation, be it anywhere in the world, from family cultural centers?
En ese aspecto, pues a nosotros, yo creo que a todas las organizaciones o movimientos nos falta todavía un buen trecho.
In that respect, well, for us and for all organizations and movements, we still have a long way to go because there is still a really big distance between the intention of actually being better and really respecting the other, in this case women, and what our real practice is.
Y no me refiero solo a la coartada esta de que así nos educaron y ni modo.
And I'm not only referring to the reaction. This is how we were educated, and there's nothing we can do, which is often the response of men and of women too, who obey this type of thinking and argue for it one way or another among other women.
We've been speaking with Subcomandante Marcos, now known as Delegate Zero, at the Center for the Documentation of Son Jarocho in Southern Veracruz. Be sure to tune in tomorrow for the final part of this FSRN exclusive interview. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 2nd of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. UN ambassadors, state representatives, and indigenous groups from all over the world reconvened in Geneva, Switzerland, Monday to work on the International Declaration for Indigenous Peoples. As part of the UN's Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, the draft was created in 1994 and since then has been the basis for biannual gatherings. Now the pressure is on to come to a final agreement, but as Anne Kayala Kelly reports, the conflict between indigenous peoples and the English-speaking members of the United Nations is making consensus difficult.
The U.S., Australia, New Zealand, and Great Britain remain steadfastly opposed to the use of any language that even hints at independence for indigenous peoples. As the working group got underway, debates over issues of land and resources also focused on perspectives that are particular to indigenous peoples, such as spirituality and culture. The British and U.S. delegations objected to the use of wording in Article 25 that says, "Indigenous peoples have the right to maintain and strengthen their distinctive spiritual and material relationship with their traditionally owned and otherwise occupied and used lands." That objection was followed by a powerful statement from Charmaine Whiteface, spokesperson for the Teton Sioux Nation Treaty Council, who raised the issue of Bear Butte, a mountain in the Black Hills currently under assault by biker clubs and developers.
Surrounding this mountain are many developers who wish to develop what are called biker bars. These are alcoholic bars for motorcycle riders who come in by the hundreds of thousands every year right near this sacred place where we go, and in order to do our prayers, we have to have the silence and the quiet. If this sacred mountain had walls and a ceiling, it would be considered a church, and there would be no way people would be building bars or outdoor concerts, arenas, right next door to it. Our delegation must insist that these two words, and material, are necessary for our spiritual relationship to many sacred places in our territory. And this is where our material relationship with this sacred place comes into play.
Luis Chavez, chairman of the proceedings, eventually stopped the discussion, saying, "If we continue to hear all of the examples of ways in which indigenous peoples have suffered because their rights have been violated, we will be here for years." Anne Kayala Kelly, reporting from Geneva, Switzerland.
Even as Charmaine Whiteface urges the UN's Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to adopt language that would protect sacred sites like Bear Butte, a bill aiming to protect it in the South Dakota State Legislature has failed. The legislation would have banned liquor establishments near the sacred site. But as South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Charles Michael Ray reports, those fighting to protect Bear Butte say they aren't giving up.
The proposal would have created a bar-free buffer zone of 4 miles around Bear Butte. Currently, plans are underway to build a biker campground near the north side of the mountain. Jace DeCorey, professor of Native American Studies at Black Hills State University, says this amounts to sacrilege.
We as Native people don't look upon that as a mountain and as a piece of property, a piece of land to be bought and sold. We look upon that as a spiritual place that our ancestors were given laws and commandments and rule of guidelines to guide us in our behavior and how we can be better human beings.
DeCorey says despite the failure of this bill, several tribal governments are now backing efforts to protect Bear Butte. She says plans are underway to set up a trust fund that could acquire and protect land near the Butte. The owner of the proposed biker campground, Jay Allen, says he wants to respect Native American culture but feels the need to go forward with plans for his establishment. Charles Michael Ray, Rapid City, South Dakota.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, using engineering and science to improve the quality of the environment for over 15 years. RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Our theme music is provided by Jeff Silverman. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
On Friday, February 3rd at 6 p.m., tune in for Bread and Roses. Host Denise Kowalczyk will talk to Planned Parenthood for an update on pro-choice issues, to local nonprofit bookstore In Other Words about some great books on motherhood and feminism, and to a board member from Insight's Teen Parent Program who will talk about teen motherhood. That's on Friday, February 3rd from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO.